Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Tuesday, April 21st. Immigration courts are being overwhelmed at the record number of detention cases. We learn how Hawaii judges are picking up the load. On the eve of a confirmation hearing for the pick for the Chief Justice of Hawaii Supreme Court, we consider what could come up, what he didn't disclose about his past. We talk to the Small Business Administration as teams are here across the islands, as well as they're trying to stand up teams to assist with the super typhoon in the Western Pacific. And a sale of the Waihewa Dam to the state nears completion. We hear from residents and dam experts about the close call we had last month. Plus, we hear about the struggles of a Big Island golf course battered by the wind and rain and lava in the air. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The backlog of immigration cases across the country is having a ripple effect here in the islands. HPR has learned that at least two federal judges in Hawaii are taking on immigration cases originating in California. It comes as states across the nation are facing a meteoric rise in what are known as habeas petitions. Earlier this month, a California judge said that thousands of these cases were overwhelming his district, and he requested backup. Here in Hawaii, at least 16 habeas petitions have been filed during the second Trump administration. A dozen were filed in the first months of this year. The data comes from the nonprofit Habeas Dockets. Leilani Stacy is the immigrants' rights attorney at the ACLU of Hawaii. She spoke with Conversation's Maddie Bender about what this legal maneuver means and why immigrants detained in Hawaii and around the country are relying on it to obtain their freedom.
Habeas petition, at its core, is really just a legal challenge or a lawsuit saying my detention, my reason for being locked up, is unlawful. And the reason it's unlawful could be for a number of reasons. It could be for a particular constitutional violation, a violation of federal law, or some other more technical regulatory issues that are going on. I think the best way to think about this is if you're thinking about normally a criminal conviction that happens either in a state or a federal court, you know, there's a jury trial and the jury says you're guilty. Someone who's in state or federal prison might say, actually, I think there was something wrong with my trial. There was something that was unfair, or, you know, the DNA evidence was messed up and I shouldn't be locked up here. That's the wrong reason. That's the basis of our habeas corpus right. It's a right that we all have under the Constitution, but it's applying in these circumstances. Basically, lawyers across the country have been really creative in using this sort of legal procedure and applying it in immigration cases. And that's why we're seeing a huge increase in the volume of habeas petitions brought nationwide.
If we translate the Latin out, and of course I want to do this because I was a classics major, habeas corpus basically means show me the body. And so how does that actually apply in these cases of immigrants being detained? What are lawyers like you on behalf of your clients arguing before courts, federal courts?
Sure. What we're arguing before federal courts is that the reason our clients are locked up is wrong. There's something that's violating, you know, their core rights, whether you're a citizen or not. We're all entitled to due process. We all have the right to be free from being locked up for an arbitrary reason. And so what we're asking the court to do is tell the federal government to release our client, to let the body out of prison, so to speak, and to really hold that there has been some unlawful reason for locking this person up in the first place.
And what's behind the pattern that we've been seeing of these cases skyrocketing nationwide? So here in Hawaii, we might have something like 15 since January of 2025. But if you look around the country, you'll see places in California, Florida, Texas, with thousands of these habeas cases. And what's behind that really meteoric rise?
We've been seeing that huge just skyrocket in the number of cases filed and habeas petitions brought on behalf of immigration clients because this administration has taken a very novel legal approach, we would argue unlawful, and several district courts have agreed with that position, that anyone who enters the country without inspection, essentially folks who are undocumented, are now all of a sudden, even if they're going through the lawful immigration process, they're now subject to being locked up while they're going through that process. And that's a new position, a new legal theory that no administration has taken before. And that means that thousands more people are subject to being locked up. I like to think of this as being in a huge ship that's starting to sink and you're bailing people, you're bailing buckets out one by one. I think habeas petitions are sort of the same thing. There's this new policy that has people just underwater. They're all being locked up. And so one by one, attorneys are having to go and get their clients out of jail.
Well, does that strike you as inefficient?
It's absolutely exhausting for both immigration attorneys, folks advocating for these people who have been locked up, and it's also clogging up the courts. You know, we've seen courts, particularly in California, just swamped and overwhelmed with these petitions. At the same time, you know, attorneys who are advocating for clients like this have tried to streamline that process by challenging whether or not this policy is lawful generally. And there have been several class actions brought across the country. A class action is kind of not just having one client you're representing, but a group of clients. Some of those have been effective, but a lot of them are now up on appeal. And so a lot of those orders are kind of not in effect across the country. And we're definitely seeing some circuits now have made decisions on this policy. But all that to say, yes, it's absolutely frustrating and it's really overwhelming just for individual attorneys and individual clients. But even going one by one is so meaningful because it means that person is not locked up for months away from their family, friends, you know, their community. And so I think that's why there's just been a persistence and a gathering together of attorneys to figure out how do we make this process as efficient as possible and, yeah, just work to get people out one by one.
On a very mechanistic level, because you yourself have represented several of these cases here in Hawaii, break down the time it takes to even file one of these petitions and the length it might go before, you know, a judge actually rules on the motion.
Yeah, so I think one of these cases, you know, can take several months to work up just because you might meet a client, then you have to sort of sift through their immigration papers or understand what's the basis for their detention. Then you have to go to FDC and try to meet with them, which sometimes can mean you're waiting outside for 2 to 3 hours. Then you get to meet with your client, et cetera. And once we go through with all the research, the preparing of a petition, et cetera, you know, that can take several weeks or even a couple months if we have to sort of wait for that legal claim to be ripe. And then when the petition is filed, frankly, the timeline can be really quick all of a sudden, which is a burden in of itself. Maybe it's not long hours, but it's a very quick turnaround that we need to supply the briefing because we're basically saying to the court, hey, this is really urgent. These person's rights are being violated and it's urgent that you get them out so that that doesn't continue to happen. So sometimes from filing a case till end only takes a month, which is very fast for civil litigation, actually. Typically, we're used to very slow processes. It takes years to adjudicate a case. But this is actually a really quick turnaround. So it's a huge burden on any individual lawyer or a legal team to be ready to respond with reply briefing in a couple of days, go appear before the court for a status conference, et cetera. So it's both long and slow, and then all of a sudden really fast and all hands on deck.
When you were brought on at the ACLU Hawaii chapter, did you know that this is what your work might look like, that you would be filing a lot of these habeas petitions?
Sure. I think when I joined the ACLU of Hawaii, this was the first time we'd had a issue area specific attorney. And so we weren't really sure what that looked like. It's also our first time really focusing on immigrants' rights. And that's just in response to the ACLU nationally, as well as here in Hawaii, really responding to this increased need. So it was definitely top of mind for me. And I think the difficult thing was when I joined in September of last year, not too many of these kinds of habeases had been filed yet here in Hawaii, even though we see this legal tool being used on the continent. It actually wasn't so common here in Hawaii. And so we really spent our time just building community relationships with the fantastic immigration attorneys we have here in Hawaii, really understanding from their perspective what the gap in the legal market was for nonprofit service providers and, you know, folks who can't afford a private attorney. And then it was up to us to kind of decide as a team how we were going to move forward. And what we've seen from our sister affiliates across the country, as well as ACLU National, is really just this work of bringing individual habeas petitions, not only to get individual clients out, but as a way to challenge these policies. You know, you were talking earlier about how it's difficult for us to file all these individual habeas petitions. But in doing so, you know, we're also challenging the government, because once we put pressure and start filing, you know, one by one, 10 by 10, hundreds by hundreds, it puts pressure on the government that has to respond to each of these petitions as well. And it's kind of like throwing sand in the gears of this deportation agenda. We might not be able to stop it, but it is trying to slow it down. And so when I was brought on, this was top of mind, you know, just how do we get people out of detention so that they can continue with their immigration processes? And also, how do we think about understanding what's happening here on the ground with people who are being detained, and understanding how that broader deportation agenda is affecting our communities here in Hawaii?
Another thing, I mean, on the numbers side that I've noticed just tracking these habeas cases is you have really seen it spike in 2026 compared to 2025. There were habeas petitions filed. We're talking on Friday afternoon. There was one filed yesterday. Why does this seem to be coming to a head right now?
As I mentioned earlier, there's been a huge increase in the filing of petitions here in Hawaii as a legal tool compared to how these were already filed in huge numbers on the continent last year, I would say. And so in some ways, maybe we're just catching up as a legal community. But I think that's likely due to the fact that we're also now just starting as a legal community to come together and really identify habeas as a method that could get people out of the detention center here as well. And that's also to say that some of the legal bases for bringing a habeas require some time, unfortunately. So one of the most common reasons to bring it is to say that someone's been locked up for too long. And so sometimes that's a waiting game, unfortunately. It's not always the case that someone can get out right away. And so that might be part of the reason, too, that we're starting to see an increase in those numbers this year as time has progressed, since people have been locked up under the first wave of pickups in 2025. Like, now those claims might be a little bit more ripe. And another, I think, is that there's just increasing awareness amongst attorneys here in Hawaii of looking to our partners on the continent, both private and nonprofit attorneys. At the ACLU of Hawaii, we actually did a habeas 101 training just for other attorneys who might be interested in bringing these kinds of petitions at the federal court. So I think we're playing catch up, not in the sense that people weren't willing to bring these before, but just really banding together and understanding, having the capacity and the legal knowledge to be able to bring those. And as I mentioned, there are some technical requirements that are needed as well. And so I think as people have seen this be a really successful strategy on the continent, are now understanding, oh, this could actually get people out, could get my clients out sooner than we thought, or, oh, this is an option that we didn't realize we had before.
How long are we talking?
That people are locked up?
Yeah, like to make a claim more ripe under a habeas petition.
Sure. So there's different reasons you can bring a habeas petition, but one in particular is called a Zedvitas claim. It's a fun U.S. Supreme Court case that says if someone's been detained for more than 6 months after a final order of removal, basically a deportation order is final, the reason they're being held is presumptively unconstitutional. So that's sort of a six-month clock for that kind of habeas. It can be different in other kinds of cases, and that's just based on case law.
And we spoke earlier about the emotional toll this takes on someone like you, on attorneys, but we haven't yet spoken about how that feels for the people who are detained inside a place like the Honolulu Federal Detention Center. I mean, what have you heard? How does it feel to be on the inside, to be going through these cases yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the people who are locked up at FDC are the reason that it's so important to bring these kinds of cases. I know it motivates me personally in my professional role. And it also is just a reminder to see people as people. I think the clients that I've met with, or potential clients, just people I've seen at FDC, have so much resilience and hope and faith, even as they're going through what is really an unfathomable experience. A lot of these people have never committed a crime ever in their life, and so I'm sure they never expected to be inside of a prison or a federal facility like that, you know, in a jumpsuit. They go in for a check-in and they're just picked out without any warning. And so, you know, I've definitely heard people talk about just how hard it is to go to sleep on the first night in a really strange environment with strangers around, but not know when you're going to get out. And at the same time, I've heard just about how the people there are really trying to, you know, band together, help each other out with practical things like, oh, how do you send an email? How do you make a phone call to your loved ones? And that really is so inspiring to me. You know, I get to walk out of there after any client interview, but those people don't know when the next time they'll see or touch grass is. And so really for me, the most rewarding part has been reuniting with clients when they're on the outside, just seeing their faces for the first time, not in a jumpsuit, and just also knowing that they'll be in their loved one's arms so soon. It's really just difficult to even explain how emotional that process is, even for me as an attorney, as someone who's, you know, just doing this in a professional capacity. But it brings me so much joy to see that happen. And I just can't even imagine what kind of relief that brings to the people who are experiencing it themselves.
That was Leilani Stacy with the ACLU of Hawaii. She spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender about the surprising rise in habeas cases around the country, as well as here in Hawaii.
Support for HPR comes from NAREIT Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping families of agricultural workers and retirees with affordable housing, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation, NAREITHawaii.com.
Tune in to HPR 2 on Sunday at 3 p.m. when the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra presents Beethoven Fest, the first in a series of concerts devoted to the works of Ludwig von Beethoven. In this matinee performance, we'll hear Symphony No. 1 and Symphony No. 3, Eroica. We'll also hear the world premiere of Ye Xiao Gong's original work, also called Eroica. That's Sunday at 3 p.m. on HPR 2, sponsored by the Rice Partnership.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii. Musician, educator, and everything music YouTuber Rick Beato features live song breakdowns and interactive Q&A this Friday. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Honolulu Civil Beat has a story about the upcoming confirmation hearing for the governor's pick for Chief Justice for the Hawaii Supreme Court. Politics editor Chad Blair joins us with a look at what could come up at tomorrow's hearing. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so the question is, there is some information that Vladimir Devens did not disclose about his political activity in the past. And yeah, will that be enough to derail this?
I don't know if it's enough to derail Governor Green's nomination to be the next CJ, right? That's what we call the Chief Justice. But it certainly has raised concerns, including for Karl Rhodes. He's chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. That's the committee that's going to hear Associate Justice Devens' confirmation hearing. And I do know there will be questions asked about why did Devens not disclose that he spent 4 years as a director on a board for a super PAC that's tied to the Carpenters Union. It's called Be Change Now. They spent $500,000 to get Josh Green elected governor 4 years ago. And so you have a situation where the person that is nominating you to the high court benefited from this organization. Why did he not disclose that on his judicial selection application? That is the question I think a lot of senators are going to have for the justice.
Yeah, and you know, I was trying to remember if we've had a situation where a CJ wasn't confirmed or just certainly faced some tough questioning by the senators.
It took me a while to think back, and I actually covered this. This is back during the Lingle years. In fact, I think I was with Hawaii Public Radio back then, and Kate Leonard, a justice on the Intermediate Court of Appeals, was nominated by Governor Lingle to be Chief Justice. She did not get that position. That was, you know, mind you, Lingle, a Republican. The Democratic Party controls the legislature. But there were concerns about Kate Leonard's qualifications. I believe she's still on the ICA. But that was some time ago, and it was a party situation, mind you. Josh Green's a Democrat. Democrats still control the legislature, so we will see. But it was enough so that Carl Rhodes spoke to me on the record, at least saying, I'm concerned about this. Why didn't you just simply disclose it? By the way, this application form we got, we were able to obtain a copy. It's quite detailed. Justice Devens did disclose other past board membership. Well, why did he leave out this super PAC? Remember, the Carpenters Union, also known as the Public Resource Partnership and others, are still very active in local politics. They've been spending money to get Jerry Kawakami elected lieutenant governor, which now seems to be an easy thing to do, given that Sylvia Lucas dropped out of the race. So this is a very influential, very active organization supporting the top contractors in the state. Why not disclose that? That doesn't seem like just another casual board membership.
Yes, and you know, in reflecting back, I know the PRP was involved in the race with former Governor Ben Cayetano, right? And that got very messy.
Oh, it sure did. That's when the governor was running, former governor at the time, running to be mayor of Honolulu, mm-hmm. took on Kirk Caldwell, and PRP, well, basically ran a campaign that got them in trouble. They essentially, really brought down Governor Cayetano unfairly and ended up being penalized for that. They had to essentially apologize and pay some money for that. So this is not an organization that is just run-of-the-mill political action committee. It is a super PAC. They have several, and they have a lot of influence. And so this is the question that will be asked. Mind you, the justice had a chance to disclose this 3 years ago when he first applied to be on the high court. We actually broke the story at the time, but only after his confirmation. So this is the second time now that he's declined to disclose this. In his defense, he's disclosed saying, I didn't think I had to. It was a past membership. The Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs didn't update their files. Therefore, the business registration was out of date. But, you know, the reality is you are clearly tied to this organization. Why not just come clean about this? I think sometimes it's what you hide rather than you disclose. It might get you in trouble.
Yeah, the optics not good. Not good at all.
Not good, exactly.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Chad, and we'll have to see how that hearing goes tomorrow. But thanks.
Thanks, Catherine. I'll be there.
That was Honolulu Civil Beat's Chad Blair. Check out his story at civilbeat.org. The major disaster declaration due to the back-to-back Kona low storms that hit Hawaii has set in motion federal aid. The Small Business Administration sent a rapid response disaster team to the islands, and we caught up with Natalie Butts, who was in Hilo this weekend. She was flying to Honolulu and then on to Guam to deal with those impacted by the super typhoon in the Northern Marianas. Under the Trump administration's second term, the SBA closed its office in Guam last year in an effort to streamline operations. It now comes under the Hawaii District Office. Here's Butts explaining how the SBA is planning to respond to these disasters in the Pacific region. Here in Hawaii, the deadline for filing for low-interest loans is in June.
What people are eligible for in terms of assistance from the SBA, there are two types of disaster loans, right? And these loans go towards homeowners, renters, businesses, and nonprofits. There are both physical disaster loans and also what we call economic injury disaster loans, right? For homeowners, those physical damage disaster loans can go up to $500,000. And for homeowners and renters, they can also get an additional $100,000 to replace any personal property that was lost or damaged as a result of the Kona low systems, including personal automobiles as well. And then for businesses and nonprofits, there are both physical damage disaster loans and also what we call economic injury disaster loans. And what economic injury disaster loans are is even if a business has not sustained physical damages as a result of those storms, there are often ripple effects to disasters such as this. In fact, most businesses will not feel the full economic impacts of a disaster until 6 to 9 months after that disaster. And so what economic injury disaster loans are meant for is to help businesses meet those ordinary and necessary financial obligations that they would have been able to meet were it not for the disaster, whether it's payroll, whether it's rent, whether it's mortgages. All of those expenses that a business has that they are not able to meet as a result of that disaster, those would qualify for an economic injury disaster loan. And for businesses and nonprofits, those both physical and economic injury disaster loans can go up to $2
million. And so what are the deadlines that people need to know, because folks may be just in the process of recovering mm-hmm. important documents, that kind of thing, but what's the deadline?
Absolutely. So for physical damages, whether you're a homeowner, business, nonprofit, or a renter, that deadline is actually coming up on June 10th, right? So these disaster loans, they are time bound, right? So as people are just putting together what their recovery plan looks like, I would recommend that everyone who thinks that they may need an SBA disaster loan, please apply. You are under no obligation to take that loan if you are approved. So it's just good to have that in your back pocket as a tool to rebuild if you think that you are going to need it, right? Economic injury disaster loans, that deadline is much further out. That is not until January 10th of 2027, so next year. And again, that's because we know that businesses may not feel the full economic impact of a disaster until 6 to 9 months after that disaster. So that additional time gives businesses the time in order to demonstrate that a disaster has had a detrimental impact to their business.
All right, so those are the main deadlines. Mm-hmm. And then you're here, just arrived from the Big Island, but you're headed to Guam, where the folks in Guam and the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas have just been hit by this super typhoon. And so you're obviously going to be out there trying to help them as well.
We are, yes. We still do not have a declaration for Guam. So right now we are just preparing and getting in place and making sure, as I mentioned, that we have officers on the ground who are assessing the situation and making sure that we are in place for a declaration should it come. That does not mean, though, that any of our attention is turned away from Hawaii and the impacts of the Kona low systems. We have both public affairs specialists and also customer service representatives to help survivors of the Kona low systems. We have them on the Big Island, we have them in Oahu, and we have them in Maui too. And I just wanted to say about the disaster loans as well. The physical disaster loans that survivors of the Kona low systems are eligible for, they are eligible for it if they are in Hawaii, if they are in Oahu and Maui. And then economic injury, the counties of Kalawao and Kauai, they are eligible for economic injury as opposed to the physical disaster loans. Those three primary counties that I mentioned, they are eligible for both physical damages and economic injury, but those what we call contiguous counties or surrounding counties, they are eligible for the economic injury disaster loan.
Only those, yeah, and that's just simply the threshold.
Exactly, exactly. And again, that's because we understand that after a disaster like this, it can have ripple effects throughout right. The entire community, whether or not you sustained physical damages as a result of a disaster. So that is why we have both the primary declared counties, which right. Are eligible for both types of disaster loans, and then a broader net that we cast for those economic injury disaster loans.
Okay, but you are headed to be in place, waiting to see if a disaster is declared for out there in the Western Pacific. And so explain how that all works, because the SBA office there, the regular office, was closed down last year.
So yes, the regular office was closed in Guam, But we were able to get officers out within 24 hours after the Senlaku passed, and it was safe to actually enter. And again, so with SBA, SBA has our district offices, but our Office of Disaster and Recovery is completely separate from that. So our Office of Disaster Recovery and Resilience, we were able to get into Guam very, very soon after the disaster hit. And there has been no interruption in terms of our services to that island.
And then as far as any applications and loans that may be processed, if that is triggered out there, how does that work?
Oh, yes. So first, a disaster has to be declared, right? And then after that disaster is declared, typically, survivors have 3 months to apply for physical disaster loans and 9 months to apply for economic injury disaster loans. And there are four ways that people can apply for an SBA disaster loan, whether they're here in Hawaii or if a disaster is declared on Guam. The first is that they can go online, sba.gov/disaster, and do an application online. If they don't want to deal with that, they can also email us at disastercustomerservice@sba.gov. We also have a toll-free number that people can call as well and do their application over the phone. But what I recommend as the best way and another option that we have available to survivors is to go in person to a disaster recovery center and submit an application there in person with our customer service representatives. Whatever way people choose to apply, one of those ways, they will then be set up with an online portal and assigned a case manager who they can communicate with directly, make sure that they're getting all of their documents that we need uploaded. And then from there, it's typically between 30 to 45 days to review that application once it's completed and when people get an answer.
And the people that are processing that, where are they located? Are they here in Hawaii or are they in California?
No, so that is actually at our offices in Texas. Our office in Sacramento, that's what's called Field Operations Center West, and that handles the disaster recovery everywhere west of the Mississippi, including the territories. But our central Office of Capital Access, that is actually based in Texas.
And we've been hearing from the Small Business Administration, and we'll have more about what you need to know if your car floated away during the recent storms here in Hawaii, or if your nonprofit or for-profit company suffered any kind of economic damages. We'll be right back after a break. Let's get back to our conversation with the SBA's spokesperson, Natalie Butts. We had wondered about the caseload for Hawaii's SBA office, given that the Trump administration closed down the SBA office in Guam last year. We asked her to clarify how the SBA was handling the processing of cases.
If a business has a regular SBA loan, right, for something that preceded the disaster, then if they had any issues with that, they would have to call the Office of Capital Access. They would have that information to call that customer service line and talk to them about their regular SBA loan.
Right, but where is that based?
It is Texas. Okay.
And is there any, I don't know, consideration for reopening the regular SBA office in Guam?
I have not heard anything about reopening the SBA office in Guam. Right now, SBA's district office in Hawaii is overseeing Guam and Hawaii and the Northern Mariana Islands. But we do have a representative on the ground on behalf of SBA, Ken Lujan, who is there in the area and can help manage SBA requests there.
Anything else you just want to underscore?
A couple things, actually, that I want to underscore about SBA disaster loans. The first thing that I want to say is typically after a disaster like what we've seen in Hawaii with the Kona Lows, people will often turn to traditional lending institutions like banks, or they'll put things on their credit card. And we really recommend that people consider an SBA disaster loan instead for several reasons. The first is that It is very low interest rates compared to what you will find at a bank or on a credit card. It's as low as 4% for businesses, fixed at 3.625% for nonprofits, and as low as 2.875% for homeowners and renters, and it has terms for up to 30 years. The reason that these loans are designed like this is we know that people have just lost everything, and they've been through one of the worst experiences of their lives. And as they recover, we really want these loans to be the thing that help people get back on their feet and for it to be manageable for them to pay it back. The other thing I will say about the benefit of an SBA disaster loan versus a traditional loan or a credit card is there is no interest that accrues and no payments that are due for 1 year after the date of that first disbursement, right? So again, it just gives people time to put their lives back together, to get back on their feet before they have to worry about those things. The other thing I will say is that in addition to that $500,000 I mentioned for homeowners, that additional $100,000 for personal property for homeowners and renters, and that up to $2 million for businesses and nonprofits, SBA also offers additional loans for mitigation. And this is very important, I find, particularly for homeowners who are trying to rebuild their homes and put their lives back together. And what that means is that in addition to up to that $500,000 cap for replacing the physical structure of their home and that $100,000 to replace personal property, there is also additional funds up to $500,000 for mitigation. Basically, the threshold we look at is that we will award up to 20% of total verified losses. And what that means is that as people rebuild, if they can pull out those line items from their builder and say, this is going towards mitigation, not just towards a hurricane or a typhoon, but if it's just any type of mitigation to protect against any natural disaster, then they can receive additional funds for that. So it's a nice way that people can get a little bit more towards rebuilding their home.
It's about resilience.
Exactly. We don't just want to help people build back. We want to help them build back stronger. And then the final thing I'll say is that after a disaster like this, sometimes people want to rebuild exactly what they lost. And sometimes people, they want to relocate either somewhere within their community or somewhere else. And so SBA loans for homeowners, it's not just for rebuilding. It can also be used for relocation.
That was Natalie Butts, who's with the U.S. Small Business Administration of Disaster Division. She's now in Guam helping to stand up services for the survivors of the super typhoon Sinlaku. The U.S. Coast Guard is still in the process of determining if the ports in that area can be reopened. Six mariners are still missing after their vessel overturned. Communication systems are still degraded, and thousands are said to be without power or water. A deal for the state to acquire the Waihewa Dam from Dole is still in talks. Next month, the State Agribusiness Development Corporation takes up a final vote while negotiators hammer out a price tag. HBR's Cassie Ordonio has been tracking this and joins us now. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. Well, so what's the latest?
So we know that the ADC Board of Directors will meet sometime in May for a final vote to go over the negotiations to reach a final agreement. That's the ADC's executive director is supposed to go through the negotiations with Dole and the water company. But as the state moves closer to acquiring this centuries-old earthen dam, there has been conflicting feelings from longtime North Shore residents and even farmers. So on one hand, there's kind of this heightened public safety risk because of the threat the dam poses to more than 2,000 North Shore residents who live in the evacuation zone of the dam's path. But on the other hand, state leaders have long said that the dam is important to local agriculture. I spoke to a couple farmers out in the North Shore area, specifically Waialua. I spoke to Daniel Carroll, who is a farmer at Hua Orchards, where he grows avocados and citrus, and his farm uses water from the Waihewa Dam.
If they remove the dam, they're going to remove access to reliable and affordable water, which for our agricultural community is going to be a devastating blow to food production. We're already in a huge battle for food production versus development. And if we lose access, availability, reliability, and affordable water, then no like farmer who's trying to actually be a production farmer can afford to farm. And so you're going to get a lot more, I know this is a dirty word, but the gentleman farms are farms that aren't really producing a lot of food for our community on some of this prime ag land. And so we're in a really important time where it is prime because there is access to water and it's an amazing soil and it grows amazing food. But without the water, it's, you know, very much more likely, in my opinion, to be developed and turned into houses.
So there are kind of like some back and forth that I've been hearing from farmers and residents. Some farmers are saying keep the dam, but they want either, you know, the state to really take care and make those upgrades to the spillway and embankment. But others are kind of worried if the state takes over, they won't do, you know, justice that they say Dole is doing, even though Dole has been fined in the past for, you know, not, you know, upgrading the spillway and the embankments. But, you know, a lot of farmers really rely on that Wahiawa Dam. It actually, the water goes to 9,000 acres of farmland in the North Shore area, feeding those farms. And, you know, going back in history, most of Hawaii's dams are relics of the plantation era. And that dam in Wahiawa was built in 1906 for that sole purpose of delivering water to plantations rather than for flood control. So we know that Dole Food Company partially owns the dam. It's been fined in the past for failing to address safety concerns such as undersized spillway. But, you know, the state is getting closer to acquiring the dam.
And they've got more than 100 dams out there.
Exactly, exactly. There's more than 100 state-regulated dams, and most are deemed high hazard. And community members have long raised concerns about, you know, the dam potentially overtopping due to increasing storms. But national experts say that most dams across the U.S. are not equipped to handle intensifying storms. And most dams are built over a century ago. Some dams need larger spillways to relieve pressure from the structure. And there's a national trend of dam removals across the country. Hawaii's not really much on that trend because there are farmers who still benefit from the dams, like the Wahiawa Dam. And then there's those who, like Nu'uanu Dam, that are used for flood control. I spoke to Brian Graber. He's the Senior Director of Dam Removal Strategy for American Rivers. And he says there's two solutions to that issue.
One is that we need to get more resources to dam safety offices. They're expected to regulate all of these structures, and they are understaffed, under-resourced. We need to strengthen their ability to enforce dam safety, and then the expectation is on the private dam owners to maintain the structures, with the added challenge being that many of these structures being built decades ago weren't built with the spillway sizes that they need to handle the storms that we're getting now. So they need to have some retrofit, some rebuild, and then significant maintenance over time. And so as a result, we're seeing an increasing trend of removing dams that are no longer serving an important purpose, that are uneconomical, that are unsafe. And that trend has increased greatly. To date, more than 2,300 dams have been removed around the country. And there's a really great example just a few years ago in Hawaii of the Kapakolua Dam, which was removed in 2022 after a very similar incident. This was a dam that forced evacuations downstream during a storm. And it was already on the docket to be removed, but it was a 57-foot high dam, and it ultimately was removed.
And Brian also talked about the issues of the dam safety offices across the country.
So the state of dam safety really isn't good across the country. State dam safety offices, who are expected to regulate private dams around the country, are universally understaffed, they're underfunded. And with so many dams out there, a significant percentage of them are considered high hazard dams, meaning if they were to fail, they could kill somebody downstream. So of the roughly 90,000 dams that are in the national inventory, about 16,000 of those are high hazard. And of those, around 2,500 of them are in poor or unsatisfactory condition. So that's like one in six of the dams out there that could kill somebody if they failed are in poor condition. So we are absolutely not keeping up with climate change. We're not keeping up with the need to have larger spillways than were needed when the dams were built, you know, 100 years ago. And it's becoming a looming crisis. And that has shown up in the data. You know, back in the 90s, something like there were three incidents like the Wahiawa incident per year on average. In the last 10 years, there have been 76 on average per year of those types of incidents, either failures or emergencies that force evacuations or some kind of intervention.
Yeah, public safety is so important.
Exactly.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Cassie, for this report.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to HPR's Cassie Ordonio. She's been tracking the sale of the Waihoua Dam to the state. Read her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Olson Trust, envisioning a Hawaii where its people are supported by the land, and the land is taken care of by its people. OlsonTrust.com.
While F understands just how brutal the regime can be, she has come to believe that the only answer to reform Iran's government is from within. Which is why, when the threat to the regime came from the outside, through the U.S. and Israel, she was especially against it.
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering the Master of Human Resources Management. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu/executive.
You know, those recent storms took out a number of trees across the state, but on a Big Island golf course, the damage from the rain and winds weren't the only thing it had to contend with. HPR's Big Island contributor Betsy Brown joins us this morning with the story. Hi, Betsy.
Hi, Catherine.
Hey, so you're talking about the golf course out at Volcano.
Yes, there's actually a small golf course, and it's pretty unique because it's so close to the Kilauea Caldera. It's about a mile as the bird flies from the caldera to the golf course. So they have a lot of unique challenges as a result of that. But also we've had the challenge of weather, as you mentioned. We know it affected a lot of the state. And the winds and the rain were significant from the Kona lows. But I'm looking at actually right now the weather data from the National Weather Service for those days from March 10th to March 16th from the first Kona low. And it shows the summit area had like between 20 and 30 inches of rain. So that's a significant amount. It's shown in purple on the map. And there was a lot of damage, of course. And then over on the other summit areas, like over at Mauna Kea, they had blizzard conditions and wind speeds of 110 miles an hour. Down here, there were still strong wind gusts, not as high. But Kilauea Military Camp had roof damage. There were lots of uprooted and down trees throughout Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. And you might remember there were a lot of closures because of that. Volcano School of Arts and Sciences even closed its nearby campuses for the week after spring break because of damage. And the golf course also lost several trees. And so their front nine holes actually haven't reopened since the March 10th lava fountaining episode. So it was closed then because of Tephra, and then the Kona wind came through. So I spoke with General Manager Don Crozier about the different challenges they've had. She was cleaning up Tephra at the time, and this was just a couple of days before they reopened again. And she told me about what happened during the last April 9th lava fountaining episode.
It's basically, you know, falling rocks coming at you. So we quickly just shut down the course for the safety of our employees and our golfers, got everybody off the course and locked up and went home.
So this eruption episode was a narrow band of Tephra that came through from the caldera. It landed in a lot of the overlooks by Kilauea. in the national park, and Kilauea Military Camp also got hit with a lot of Tephra. Just yesterday, I was in that area, and I saw the basketball court was still covered with Tephra, and lots of other roadways and walkways there are still covered as well because it's such a big cleanup job. And several homes in the neighborhood that's near the golf course across the highway from Kilauea Military Camp also got hit with Tephra. It wasn't as thick as it was in March, but it still is a lot, and it did leave the golf course. You know, you typically expect them to be bright green. It was literally black because of the lightweight rocks. And so every time this happens, the entire staff of 16 at the golf course pitches in, and Don told me the various tools that they use to clear off the greens.
We have a large blower, and so we blow it. We have several backpack blowers and handheld blowers that we use for the smaller areas, and then it's a lot of shoveling, raking, and scooping it off.
And that large blower that she mentioned, I actually, when I met her for the first time, she was towing it with a golf cart, and it really is the size of a large snow blower that they would use in, you know, large parking lots and areas that get a lot of snow. This is the third time that Tephra has fallen on the golf course. So the last two episodes, it actually closed it. And that March 10th episode, episode 43, left a thicker covering that was also wider. And so they didn't even really get the chance to clean that up for a while because the Kona low happened just a couple of days after it. And they lost several trees because of that storm. They're still cleaning it up. In fact, they reopened last Wednesday 9 holes, but the front 9 holes of the golf course where the Kona low damage was, those still haven't opened. But Dawn says she hopes the golf course can reopen by the end of the month. And you can hear the emotion in her voice when she talked with me about getting to this point.
You know, we appreciate the community and all the support that we've gotten, and our team has worked really hard to get to this far. And yeah, I guess there's not a lot of places in the world that deal with this, and so we're doing our best.
Yeah, they've been through a lot.
Yeah, they've been through a lot, but there are some plus sides, and one of them is that the pieces that do get left on the golf course because they can't be blown or raked away, they get mowed down, and Dawn said it's a good fertilizer. And in fact, the groundskeepers I spoke with, they told me that they're holding on to the giant piles that they've collected.
Yeah, the funny thing is before this all happened, we actually went and priced a load of cinder, and they told us it was like 10 grand. So now we're keeping everything.
That's crazy. 10 grand.
Yeah, so, you know, advantages, and but we're still watching this next episode closely. Precursory activity has begun. The fountaining forecast is today through Sunday. If it happens today, there are light winds, so there could be some Tephra fall, more confined to the summit area. So we'll have to watch and see if the golf course has to deal with that mess again.
All right. Well, you stay safe out there. Stay dry. Hopefully the weather cooperates. But thanks so much, Betsy.
Yes. Aloha.
That was HVAC contributor Betsy Brown with a look at how a Big Island golf course is faring with the hits from the recent storm and the volcano. You can find her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, that's a wrap for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to jump in the AI pool. Why do we put our trust in something when maybe we shouldn't? Got concerns about artificial intelligence in your everyday life? Call or talk back line 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or reach out on social media. You can find the conversation on our website as a podcast on Apple and Spotify. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for the conversation.